annual Memorial Day speech. I think this is the first one starting this year. I've called this Memorial Day, True Courage and Fearlessness from Death. Now, I think a lot of people may be here because it's a three-day weekend. Memorial Day is traditionally kind of the beginning of the summer season. It's a national holiday, and that's how most people think of it. We sort of look at the three-day holidays, from Memorial Day at the beginning of the summer season, Labor Day at the end. But there's actually wasn't a meaning behind Memorial Day originally that most people don't really think about too much. Originally, it was actually started after the Civil War in the United States to honor those who had died in battle. And it says that Memorial Day is a day for remembering and honoring military personnel who died in the service of their country, particularly those who died in battle as a result of wounds sustained in battle. So this was the original purpose of it, although I think that's been forgotten, you know, for some time. So then I was wondering, well, why are we honoring those who've died in battle? I mean, people die in all kinds of different ways, and people do all sorts of different activities. Why those who in battle? Well, there's an assumption there, isn't there? There's an assumption that there was probably some courage, perhaps heroism involved. And, or if nothing else, that one overcame one's fear, one's shortcomings, whatever, and gave up oneself for the greater good. In this case, the good of the country or whatever the particular cause was. So this idea of a personal sacrifice for a higher cause is sort of what we can think of as someone being heroic or courageous. And even in our spiritual scriptures, we have many great heroes. And, you know, many people who are noted for their chivalry in battle, Arjuna, the Pandavas, Krishna, Balaram, Ramachandra, you know, and so many. So there's so many examples we have of heroic leaders, both in the material world and in the spiritual world. So we do understand from the scripture that there's both material and spiritual heroism and material and spiritual fearlessness. So that's what I want to talk about a little bit today. And we're going to read a verse and purports about how to become truly fearless. And it's not necessarily how to become fearless on a battlefield, although we could say that this entire experience in the material world is somewhat of a battlefield here in our battle against Maya, against material energy here on this planet. So the verse I'm going to read is from the Srimad Bhagavatam 2:6, 18 and 19. Let's see, 18 is Sumartasya Bhaya Yesho Marchamanam. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the controller of immortality and fearlessness, and he is transcendental to death and the fruit of actions of the material world. O Narada, O Brahman, it is therefore difficult to measure the glories of the Supreme Person. Deathlessness, fearlessness, and freedom from the anxieties of old age and disease exist in the kingdom of God, which is beyond the three higher planetary systems and beyond the material coverings. That's 2:6, 18, 19. This is, they're two very long purports, so this is part of the purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Lord, who is the leader of all living entities, can award all the qualities of his personality unto the devotees, including immortality, and spiritual bliss. In the material world, there is always anxiety or fearfulness in the hearts of all living entities. But the Lord, being himself the supreme fearless, also awards the same quality of fearlessness to his pure devotees. Mundane existence is itself a kind of fear, because in all mundane bodies, the effects of birth, death, old age, and disease always keep a living being compact in fear. In the mundane world, there is always the influence of time, which changes things from one stage to another, and the living entity, originally being avikar, or unchangeable, suffers a great deal on account of changes due to the influence of time. the changing effects of eternal time are conspicuously absent in the immortal kingdom of God, which should therefore be understood to have no influence of time and therefore no fear whatsoever. So Srila Prabhupada is nicely explaining this difference between the material and the spiritual world, where the material world is considered to be a place of fearfulness, a place of anxiety, and a place where there is constant difficulties for the living entity, where the spiritual world, as Prabhupada is saying, there's no influence of time and therefore no fear whatsoever. So we know that the spiritual world is called Vaikuntha. Vaikuntha means the place of no anxiety. That's hard to imagine, isn't it? Can you imagine that going through the day and just being absolutely happy and no anxiety and no difficulties, no trouble? I mean, it's almost hard for us to imagine such a place, but yet it is there because it is the spiritual world. And we know from the Bhagavad Gita that the spiritual world is quite different than the material world. In fact, sometimes it is almost the reverse opposite. The example is given of the banyan tree, where the reflection of the banyan tree in the water, it says where the roots are upward and the branches are downward and everything. In other words, it Prabhupada explains those things which are highest in the material world maybe are lowest in spiritual reality and vice versa. So very, very different experience in the spiritual world, that kingdom of God, where there is no fearlessness because there is not this change that Prabhupada is talking about, change due to the influence of time. Now, in one sense, we can sort of say that's a nice way of saying that we are born and die, right? In other words, for every one of us, there is old age, death, disease will come at a certain time. And so that fearfulness is always there. So how does this apply to us, even devotees, even those who are followers of God, who are convinced of the spiritual world, and how that there is this place Christians may think of as heaven, and of course we think of it as the spiritual world, Vaikuntha, Goloka Vrindavan. But there's no fear in that place, but what about in this material world? How do we become fearless here? And not by being very, very brave in a battle and getting a medal and getting recognized in a Memorial Day parade, not in that way. But there is another way that we can actually obtain fearlessness and heroism. In purport to 425.25, Srila Prabhupada explains there are two types of heroes. Prabhupada says every living entity is a hero in two ways. When he's a victim of the illusory energy, he works as a great hero in the material world, a great leader, politician, businessman, industrialist, etc. And his heroic activities contribute to the material advancement of civilization. That's one. On the other hand, one can also become a hero by being the master of the senses, a Goswami. Material activities are false heroic activities, whereas restraining the senses from material engagement is great heroism. Interesting, huh? Every living entity has the freedom to be attracted by material nature or to stand as a hero and resist that attraction. It is simply a question of the living entities being attracted or not being attracted. There is no question of his being forced to come into contact with material energy. In other words, we're all forced to be in contact with material nature while we're here. One who can keep himself steady and resist the attraction of material nature is certainly a hero and deserves to be called Goswami. And of course, this word Goswami means master of the senses. So in the Bhagavatam, in the 11th canto, there's a long string of chapters called the Uddhava Gita. And Lord Krishna instructs Uddhava directly on many, many aspects, similar to Arjuna did in the Bhagavad Gita, but even more in depth about the process of devotional service. And in chapter 19, Krishna asks a series of questions to Krishna. Did I say that wrong? Uddhava asks Krishna a series of questions, yes. You know, that's one of those senior moments. Okay. One of the questions he asks is, what is heroism? Uddhava asks Krishna directly. And Krishna gives a very detailed answer to all of his questions. And in chapter 30, verse 37, he specifically talks about heroism. And Krishna says, real heroism is to conquer one's natural tendency to enjoy material life and reality as seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead everywhere. So the natural tendency to enjoy material life, that's there. Every single one of us. All of us are born in this material world. We have material bodies that have material senses. We have a material mind that is processing all of that sensory information. We have a material intelligence, which is actually analyzing it all and trying to figure out the best way that, you know, that the mind can be satisfied by getting all of this material sense gratification. So all that's going on, and that's difficult to overcome. And in the purport, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur talks about heroism. He says, real heroism is opposition to one's nature of rajas and tamas, lust and anger, or advertising one's qualities, such as learning. It is not merely prowess in battle. So we've kind of gone now beyond the material concept of having some sort of physical courage based around the body to having this real courage to resist the temptations of the material energy, of this material world, the desire to enjoy one's senses at the expense of what is actually right and wrong, what is actually in the interest of the self, what is actually the desire of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that's a difficult thing. So why do we consider this heroic to give up one's lower nature, to give up the material energy? It's a very difficult struggle to overcome. As we were saying, we have conditioned natures that may have been in this material world. We may have been here for hundreds, thousands. We don't know how many lifetimes we've been here. And in every one of those lifetimes, we as the spirit soul are becoming conditioned. And that conditioned nature is growing and developing. And we have more and more experiences of this material world. You know, our mind becomes more and more involved in it, and so on. And so it becomes very, very strongly part of our nature. So these desires are very deeply ingrained. And those desires may even be contrary to a real spiritual nature. In other words, there are things that are in our best spiritual interest, but because of the strong conditioning, we will act differently. We may act in such a way that actually is antithetical to our real spiritual nature or spiritual benefit, but yet it is there because the pullings are so strong of the three modes of nature and our conditioning. You know, so it does take, it takes some particular spiritual strength and understanding. Another thing is that it's not exactly socially popular or culturally acceptable to most people to engage in controlling the senses. This isn't a real popular topic, right, when you begin to talk to people. The first thing that people don't really want to hear too much about, well, actually, you shouldn't be trying to enjoy your senses, and you shouldn't be doing this, and you shouldn't be, you know, taking alcohol or doing this or that or the other things. Often that's not very popular. So the living entity is constantly bombarded by what we call bad association or the those desires of others. In other words, surrounded by people in the material world who all have similar natures of being attracted to this material energy. And why? Because we wanted to forget Krishna, to try to be here to enjoy this material energy independently of God. So it becomes difficult to overcome. It's very deeply rooted. There's one interesting word, actually, in the 1111 of Bhakti Visambhrita Sindhu, the Anyabilashita Shunyam verse, of course, very famous verse, the root verse of the nectar of devotion, or of the Bhakti Visambhrita Sindhu, which actually explains what pure devotional service is. And in Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's purport on that, he talks about this word Anyabilashita. And he says this means devoid of all other desires which are as deep rooted as one's nature. Deep-rooted is one's nature. So it's a very natural thing to have all these material desires. Sometimes devotees are concerned about this. They'll say, I have these material desires. Well, yes, we all do. You're not alone. You know, join the Material Desire Club. We're all part of it. However, we have a process. We have a way of overcoming material desires. We have a way of overcoming it. We don't try to say they don't exist. or that I'm completely pure and I'm, you know, aloof from these, but no. There's a process of devotional service that allows us to purify those desires through utilizing everything, using the senses, using the body, using all of our resources to serve Krishna. And in that way, those desires tend to diminish over time and become purified so that our desire becomes to serve Krishna, to serve the Guru, to perform acts of devotion, acts of devotional service, rather than material enjoyment. And Krishna understands that this can be difficult for the living entity. Another verse that I've always liked, this is also in that Uddhava Gita portion. This is Bhagavatam 11, chapter 14, text 18. Krishna says, "My dear Uddhava, if my devotee has not fully conquered his senses, he may be harassed by material desires, but because of his unflinching devotion for me, he will not be defeated by sense gratification." I find this a very wonderful promise that Krishna gives. Krishna's saying, yes, you may have some material desires. You haven't fully conquered your senses. But if you have devotion to me, you will not be defeated by sense gratification. In other words, if it seems like it's a struggle, Krishna's saying, if you are devoted to me, you will win that struggle. And I will help you win that struggle. And that's Krishna's promise to his devotee. His devotee shall never perish. He says, I am the strength of the strong. He says, I give them, you know, the intelligence to come to me. He also says that to those devotees who worship him, that he preserves what they have and carries what they lack. In other words, anything that where we may be a little bit deficient is not a problem. Krishna will carry us and will give us the strength that we need to serve Krishna and to become Krishna's devotee. Okay? So, why is there fear in the material world? I'm going to backtrack a little bit here. We're saying this material world is full of fear, et cetera, et cetera. And when you think about it, I mean, are people really that fearful? Everybody has some fears, right? When they do polls, what do you think people list as their greatest fears? Most people say, what are people afraid of? Yeah.
I actually heard public speaking is number one.
Public speaking's up there, yeah, and that's one of the ones. Anything else? Some of us, like myself, don't have that. We just think, you know, we love every microphone we ever saw. But yeah, for most people, public speaking is a great fear. What else? Yeah, I'm sure humiliation. I didn't see that listed, but I could really see that. Yeah, the fear of being, not being respected, et cetera. Go ahead. Death. Yeah. There's two levels here. One, we're talking about the sort of phobias, like public speaking. By the way, other ones that the number one listed was snakes. Snakes, public speaking, spiders, you know, like that. But some psychologists say if we go deeper than that, the greatest fear for people is exactly what you said, is death. Yeah. Along with death, the unknown, you know. In other words, people don't know what's going to happen. What will happen to me after this lifetime? What is my destination? Will it be painful? What, you know, so many things. Yeah, people do have a great fear of death. It's true. So, and of course, this is what our scriptures tell us. The Bhagavad Gita tells us that real fear is fear of the four miseries of birth, death, disease, and old age. And in this material world, it's described that there are the four propensities of all living entities, of all animals, including human beings, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And sometimes defending is defined as fearing, either fearing or defending. Prabhupada and other acharyas use them both ways. So this fearing is a natural, in fact, we see it not just in human beings, but animal, you know, in other words, in the animal kingdom, you look at, you know, you think nature looks so sweet, you know, so nice and beautiful out there, you know, but, you know, it's a hard struggle for survival for the living entities out there, you know, and jiva, jiva, sajivanam, one living entity is food for another, is the general rule, you know, and so in other words, the hard struggle for existence is going on at every level out in this material world. So ultimately, everyone is facing birth and death. And there's no real shelter from that. At least there's no material shelter. Because all of our money, our fame, our strength, nothing is really going to save us at the time of death. We may be a great hero, and one may be courageous in battle, but it doesn't really make too much difference. I mean, the person is going to either die on the battlefield or they're going to die of a disease 30 years later. One way or the other, everyone is facing this. And that fear comes primarily because of one concept. And that concept is called false ego, or false identification with the body. Because we identify so strongly with this body, the sense of not having this body or the death or the end of this body is very fearsome for people. Okay? So in 326.16, it says, the influence of the Supreme Personality of God is felt in the time factor. We hear about this time factor a lot in the scriptures. Time causes the fear of death due to the false ego of a deluded soul who has contacted material nature. So in other words, if we actually knew that we were the pure spirit, the soul, the atma, the jiva, that is within this body and not the body, and we were different from the body, that fear would not be there. For the pure devotee, for one who is very advanced in Krishna consciousness, understands his spiritual relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there is no fear. There is no fear of death. So that's something that we can come to. We may not be there 100%, but as we advance in Krishna consciousness, I think that's something that we do experience. We experience more and more sense of fearlessness and more of a sense of Krishna's protecting us at every moment, at all times, in every circumstance. So how do we deal with all the things that go on in this world? I think of natural disturbances, and then it thunders. Although this is a natural disturbance, we're very happy to see. We've been in natural disturbances. Normally, Florida is a very rainy place, but we've been in this severe drought for the last 3 months. It's very strange. Nothing's predictable anymore. You know, it's like, as a global warming, whatever it is, it's certainly climate change. Everything is different. Everything is very erratic. We can't really count on much anymore. That's what it seems like. In many ways, you know, the foundations that people sort of depend upon don't seem to be as strong. So we have to find those things of strength, those things we can depend upon, which are permanent, which are absolute. And that which is permanent and absolute is of the spiritual nature, not the material. We're not going to find it here. So the devotee expects the protection of the Lord. Right? There's a very nice verse from Hari Bhakti Vilas, Anikulasya Sankopam Pratikul Yasya Varjanam. I won't read all. The six divisions of surrender. And they are accepting things favorable to devotional service, rejection of unfavorable things, the conviction that Krishna will always give protection. The acceptance of the Lord as one's guardian or master. Full self-surrender and humility. Very, very wonderful verse. And because I think the important one here is that we always feel the conviction that Krishna will give protection. This verse is quoted in Majjhalila 22.100 from Hari Bhakti Vilas. And in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada writes a purport on this. He says, situated in everyone's heart, Krishna deals differently according to the living entity's position. The living entity's position is to be under the protection of the illusory energy or under Krishna's personal protection. When the living entity is fully surrendered, he is under the direct protection of Krishna, and Krishna gives him all intelligence by which he can advance in spiritual realization. So again, very, very wonderful description that Srila Prabhupada is giving us of how the devotee is protected by Krishna and helped to attain Krishna consciousness, and therefore he's never really fearful. If we feel Krishna's protection, then it saves us from that fearfulness, abhaya, in the spiritual world. Another nice verse, Narayana Parasarve kutaschana pibhipyate svarga pavarga nirkena apitul yartadarshina. Devotees solely engaged in the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Narayan never fear any condition of life. For them, the heavenly planets, liberation, and hellish planets are all the same. For such devotees, are interested only in the service of the Lord. Right. So, again, Krishna promises this protection, and the reason we emphasize this so much is because this is actually one of Krishna's most important teachings. In fact, the final teaching to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita in the 18th chapter is exactly this. Sarvadharmam prachaja ma sucha. Do not fear. Krishna says, I will give you all protection. Give up all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me, and we will have Krishna's protection. Haribo. I can finally stop watering my fruit trees and flowers and everything. See, it doesn't take much to make me happy. A little rain. Okay. As we develop a mode of surrender, Krishna, we realize that Krishna is our shelter and Krishna's working in our best interest. And so the devotee sees everything is directly coming from the Lord. All good and bad conditions are a special mercy, an opportunity for us to learn. Whatever happens, it may seem good, it may seem bad. It's on the absolute platform if it's coming from Krishna. So a devotee turns to Krishna in the time of danger, of course, or whenever he's having any difficulty. Just as we saw Prahlada Maharaj, he remembered Krishna at all times. It's pretty hard to compete with. I think I'll wrap up here. So even in the neophyte stage, neophyte means all of us, new devotees, devotees who are still sadhakas, still on the path, on the process of becoming devotees, becoming surrendered to Krishna. Our surrender in the beginning is from the order of the spiritual master, and it may be not in the highest level of devotion, but it is still not ordinary. And whatever happens to a devotee is not ordinary karma. So we have an example, say, of a ball. If I take a rubber ball and I bounce it against the wall and it bounces back to me, that's mechanical, according to the laws of physics, right? We'll have a certain... But if I throw the ball and it's caught and tossed back to me, that's like Krishna taking the ball and handing it back to us. So it may look the same. Some difficulty may look the same. But one is the ball just bouncing back mechanically at us, that's karma. And the other situation is Krishna directly giving us that result so that we can advance in Krishna consciousness and surrender to Him. Okay, so this is Krishna's great kindness. He does give us what we need in this material world and helps us to advance spiritually. Last verse, the surrendered souls are called akuta bhaya, free from fear. They are doubtless and fearless, and their entrance into the spiritual kingdom is guaranteed. Hari Bol, all glories to Prabhupada. That was pretty exciting. Anybody want to try to venture a question or comment? Brew, over here.
Thank you for... Hari. Thank you for class, Prabhu. It's always nice to see contemporary events related back into Krishna consciousness. We can think about Memorial Day now in light of spiritual fearlessness. Yeah. I was curious about, you said that it was important to reject rajas and tamas.
Sorry.
It was important to reject rajas and tamas, but we've heard that sattvagun is a good platform. I'm wondering how much of our nature is, our spiritual nature is reflected in sattvagun. And is any of our nature also reflected in rajas or tamas? Or is that why we should reject them outright, because our spiritual nature is just not reflected in them at all?
Now, that's a little complex, because the sattvaguna, or mood of goodness, is considered to be the platform by which we can be Krishna conscious and perform devotional service. But at the same time, sattvaguna itself is a mode of nature, and so we ultimately want to be in the mood of shuddha-sattva, or pure goodness, which is above the mode of goodness. Right now, our natures are very mixed when we say our nature, but if we're talking about our pure nature, the pure spirit soul, of course, is completely above the three modes of nature. Was there more to your question? I'm not sure if I quite got it.
Yeah, I guess I'm curious as to how much we can glean into who we really are by observing our activities in sattvaguna, or if that's also not a clear indication of who we are, if we have to be even more internal than that.
Probably. It's very difficult, because we tend to see the self. Most of us as devotees, we do kind of understand we're not our body, but it's very hard to become free from the conception of the mind and intelligence. So those things that are in our mind and intelligence, we tend to think of that as who we are. And it may or may not be, depending upon, in other words, our mind intelligence can be very much in the lower modes of nature, or in the higher modes of nature, or be very transcendental. Now, I would say we can't really probably discern a lot from our current material body, spirit, physical, sensual activity as to what is our true spiritual nature. But we can use those things, we can use those propensities, we can use whatever they are in Krishna's service, and they become purified. And then eventually the pure spiritual body will emerge, sort of from behind that, underneath that. Yeah. Anything else?
I was thinking that we have our devotee Ambarish, who has donated so much to build up Mayapur Dham. And I read in the TOVP newsletter that there were all these rich Hindus who wanted to meet Ambarish because he was the grandson of Henry Ford.
I kind of missed that. There were so many people, TOVP, so many rich people. What about?
There were so many rich Hindus.
Rich Hindus, yeah.
Who wanted to meet Ambarish because he was the grandson of Henry Ford.
Oh, I see.
And Henry Ford was a hero on a material level, because he reduced the working hours of people who worked for him from 12 hours to 8 hours. He gave them days off. He gave them paid vacations. He increased the industrial power of the United States.
Yeah.
Whereas Ambarish, for devotees, we love Ambarish because he's a great soul, and he helped Srila Prabhupada so much in building the Mayapur temple, in making life members before he even started building the Mayapur temple.
Yeah.
He'd go out on life membership with
Wonderful example.
So we have two different points of view on who is the hero.
Well, that's a very good example. Those are the two type of heroes that Prabhupada talked about in that purport I read, right? In other words, the one who is a great industrialist, a great economic, powerful person, and his great-grandson is a spiritual hero for his devotional service. Very nice point. It's also, where I thought you were going with the beginning was that people are attracted, even devotees, somewhat attracted because of that material opulence. And if so, that's fine. We can use that in Krishna's service. If somebody thinks, he must be a whatever, because, he's from this great industrial family, maybe it's better to give money to him. If they think that, great. So, it's like, use what you can in Krishna's service. And if you have name and fame, You know, just like Prabhupada was so encouraging to George Harrison, right? Because George Harrison was a great personality, you know, loved by just millions, adored by millions of people. So he had that opportunity to bring people to Krishna consciousness because of what may have been a material attraction to bring them to a spiritual position, in the same way that the Ford family can now with Ambarish. Nice example. Anything else? Before we get drowned out. Yeah, over here. Yeah.
Someone here. I have the mic, though. Yeah.
What? Oh, back. Okay.
Yeah, I have a question regarding. You said there is no time in the material world, in the spiritual world, correct?
There's no time. Well, yeah.
How do they run programs?
How does what?
How do they run any program? Stop.
Let's clarify that. It's described that there is no material time. Material time is the wearing factor, the factor that brings things to fall apart, to disintegrate, so there's none of that. There's a sense of time in the spiritual world to enhance the pastimes of Krishna. For instance, it says in the Bhagavatam that the rasa dance was on, the full moon night of the Sharat season. Well, how could there be a full moon night of Sharat season if there was absolutely no sense of time? No, wouldn't make any sense. You think about it, if there was no sense of... One of the acharyas, Jiva Goswami, explained it. There has to be a sequence of activities. There's a sequence of activities, and that helps the pastimes to develop. You know, without that, what would be just sort of one big... It'd almost be impersonal, wouldn't it? You know, we're just one big sense of bliss here with no real, you know, variety, activities, time, daytime, nighttime, time to get up, time to go to the pasturing grounds, time to milk the cows, right? That's all there in Krishna Loka and in all there in Vrindavan. So there is a sense of time, but it does not have the wearing, the destroying factor of the time factor as in the material world.
Got it. Thank you, bro.
Okay. Well, there's some... Here somewhere.
Okay. Yeah. Hare Krishna Prabhu. So my question comes from related to Memorial Day, the part in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is telling Arjuna to fulfill his duty as a Kshatriya and to fight, and if he's victorious, and I'm paraphrasing, but if he's victorious, he'll enjoy the kingdom, and if he is killed, he'll attain the heavenly planets.
Yeah.
My question was that unique to that time and those fighting on the battlefield at Kurukshetra, or does that apply to those that are fighting in Kali Yuga for whatever the reason in the military for their respective countries? And dying, are they still, they're subject to their karma, or because they're dying in that kind of way, do they also ascend?
Well, that's an interesting question. My understanding is because it was Krishna's desire, Krishna's directly orchestrating, right, the whole battle of Kurukshetra. It was all his desire to rid the earth of the influence of all the demoniac kings. He also wanted to glorify his devotees. He wanted to engage in these different pastimes with devotees. So I think that's unique. I don't think it applies to every material circumstance. Although karma is an interesting thing. Now we're talking about material karma so much, not like a spiritual situation where Krishna's directly engaging someone like Arjuna in his service. But for instance, somebody who is fighting under the order of his government doesn't... The karma for that killing doesn't occur to them because they're doing it under the higher order. Now, the person who's giving the order, it might occur to them. You know, they may have some karma if it's not a righteous battle like that. But no, I think the example you gave with Arjuna is different. That's unique. That's a spiritual relationship. You know. Okay. All right. I think we should probably quit here. Everybody gonna, good luck getting over to Prashanam. Hari Bol, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.